From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Congress passed sweeping legislation that would overhaul the way corporations report earnings and the way auditors check them. If you're the kind of market watcher who thinks that government proposals have an immediate effect on the stock market, this plan did a lot better than George W. Bush's speech of a few weeks ago. This time, the market rebounded, briefly. Companies that formerly had their way with the figures will become tightly regulated under these reforms, with one important side effect: the media will be able to keep a more watchful eye on corporations. Before Enron, part of the problem was a media conflict of interest. The bull market benefited media too, but much corporate malfeasance was simply out of the press's view. Our producer-at-large Mike Pesca asks why the press was caught so flat-footed.
Tyco, Enron, WorldCom, Global Crossing, Adelphia, Quest. This is the short list of the most prominent companies under investigation for fraud or misstated earnings. It's also a list of companies who are under investigation or whose stocks tanked more than 90% before any news organization reported on possible illegalities. That fact, taken with the undeniable bullishness of most business coverage, has led press critics to wonder, how did the media miss this story? A better question might be, if a tree booked phantom profits in a forest, the forest representing a runaway bull market, you know what? That's not such a good analogy. Here's a better way to explain how companies cook the books under the media's radar. It comes from Newsweek's Alan Sloan.
If you're running out of the baseline and you run a foot out of the baseline, they call you out. If you're running a mile and a half out of the baseline, no one even sees you. That's what happened here. If you're making up the numbers, then the numbers are all going to look good, aren't they?
The point is that without rules, journalists are without their tools.
The way you usually find these things is by finding a discrepancy between the reported profits and the cash flow numbers. What happened at Enron was they made up all of their numbers. At WorldCom, it was even worse. And there's no defense against phony numbers unless you know they're phony, and you need to have some reason to know that they're phony because you normally don't go in assuming that.
Which isn't to say that journalists were totally defenseless against indefensible accounting practices. Even when the numbers aren't available for crunching, people are. Workers at companies like Enron and WorldCom still go out to local watering holes and, over a pitcher of sangria, may let slip details of an off-balance sheet ledger entry. A long shot, but it could happen, according to Fortune magazine's executive editor, Joe Nocera.
To break a story like that, a news organization would either have to have an incredible intuition that this was going on and assign a reporter, or they'd have to get a tip from somebody.
Fortune magazine itself had an early article on Enron, which, while it just scratched the surface of Enron's misdeeds, did at least raise questions about the balance sheet. The information came from a place that makes some news outlets nervous.
One great source for red flags in my profession are the short sellers. Corporations hate them because they view them as tainted, because there's no question that as the stock goes down, they make money, because that's what short sellers do. On the other hand, it was a short seller, a guy named Jim Chanos, who really was the first one to basically say Enron in particular was an emperor with no clothes.
But it takes a certain kind of journalistic institution, one with resources, patience, and expertise to check the short seller's tips. Fortune was one such institution. The New York Times also issued frequent predictions of a bursting bubble, but Joe Nocera says the buying public didn't buy it.
You know, people really didn't want to hear bad stuff about companies.
Former corporate headhunter Larry Elliott says that as a culture, America is almost pathologically unable to receive warnings.
You know, we go back in history and say there were signs about Pearl Harbor, there were signs about the World Trade Center, there were signs about this marketplace, and there were some people who were trying to get some weak signals out, but people were not ready to hear the warning.
Elliott is the author of the new book, How Companies Lie. His thesis is that companies lie because they can, aided and abetted during the bull market by a news media acting, in 12-step jargon, as enablers. He adds to the list of who bears the blame those who blame the bears, the investing public itself.
There's nothing more dangerous than a hot market and an ignorant investor. If the market just started rolling upward right now and just looked like it was going to go again, these stories that we're talking about would kind of be lost, and people would be jumping back on the bandwagon again, or at least most of them would.
Before you write that off as cheap cynicism, consider Joe Nocera's account of a recent Fortune article on a company that's alleged to have artificially inflated revenue, cheated investors, and whose chairman stands accused of tax evasion.
We wrote a tough Tyco story about 2 months ago having to do with some revenue issues. And I was astounded at even now, the most of the letters that we got said, you know, how dare you say these terrible things about my wonderful company and their stock is going to eventually go up and you're going to look like a bunch of dopes.
Those letter writers probably represent a minority, which may shrink further as investigators bring to light more evidence of scandal. Congress just passed a variety of measures which would tighten corporate rules. That, to return to Alan Sloan's original analogy, would place the runner back within the baseline, where he can once again be seen from the press box. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, tried to enter a guilty plea last week, but he wasn't allowed, and then this week he was allowed, but then he decided not to. Now, the most confusing part of the sentence I just read wasn't about Moussaoui's legal maneuvering. It's the phrase, the so-called 20th hijacker. Who's calling him that? Not the government. It's a media-born phrase that pops up again and again in AP articles on all the networks and countless newspapers. Last week, the New York Times ran an article explaining why the government doesn't believe he's the 20th hijacker. Then the Times called him the so-called 20th hijacker the very next day. Joining us now is Tony Losi, who's been covering the trial for USA Today, the so-called nation's newspaper. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, we invited you on because in the major papers, we noticed that your stories were among the few that regularly avoided the phrase, the so-called 20th hijacker. How come?
Two reasons. First, it does not say that in the indictment. The charges are all conspiracies. There are no actual substantive offenses alleged. And often what an indictment doesn't say is more important than what it does say. In other words, what's not in there can be critical to understanding the government's case. Secondly, I had law enforcement sources who were telling me from the beginning that they were concerned that the government does not have any concrete evidence of a direct contact between Mr. Moussaoui and any of the hijackers. Those FBI agents believe that there's a good possibility that Mr. Moussaoui was sent here on another mission, a mission separate and apart from 9/11. For those two reasons, we decided to be cautious and not call him the 20th hijacker, as others have.
So you rejected the phrase right from the start?
Yes, that's correct.
Have you ever asked your colleagues why they stick to the phrase?
No, I haven't. I just decided not to get into it. I think that some papers are doing it because it is a quick way to make a reference for people to make a connection to, oh, that's who that guy is. But the problem is that it's just not in the indictment.
What do you think are the consequences of using that phrase as often as reporters seem to be doing?
The defense would say that it could taint the jury pool. Potential jurors could associate that term with him without even thinking.
Why do you think that other people didn't come to the same conclusion you came to regarding the so-called 20th hijacker?
Well, I know from covering the various hearings that there are people who aren't used to reading indictments or sitting in court and listening to often very complicated legal arguments. I mean, the stuff is complicated. There's no doubt about it. But people, I think, aren't reading the indictment as carefully as maybe they should be and aren't listening as carefully as they should be. For example, he was very definitive about not pleading guilty to the 9/11 part of it. But on television and in newspapers, people were reporting that he, in fact, had said that he wanted to plead guilty to the 9/11 conspiracy. That's the exact opposite of what he said. Then that happened again after the guilty plea fell apart. There were people on television making the same mistakes over and over and over again.
Well, Canada's our neighbor to the north. Noriega was always the Panamanian strongman. These are cliches. Do you think there's any other reason why reporters are taken by the phrase other than sheer laziness?
Well, I think that there are so many questions about September 11th that remain unanswered. And the biggest one was, why were there five hijackers on three of the flights but only four on one? And that raises, it begs the question, there had to be somebody else out there. And Mr. Massawi is the only person who's been caught. So I think that some people have jumped to the conclusion and made the connection.
You know, the court that the trial is taking place in, is there a cliche for that place? Is that called the rocket docket?
That's correct. And they take pride in that, by the way. So it's not something that was, you know, made up by the media. The defense bar calls it that.
And you've used the phrase?
Oh, I've used it, yes, I have. And the judges over there are actually proud of that.
Did you call John Walker Lynn the American Taliban?
Yes, I did. I did, because he was on TV saying that, admitting that he was a Taliban fighter.
Of course, you know, the correct phrase is the American Talib.
Talib, is that right?
So you don't eschew the apt cliche, just the inaccurate, actionable ones.
Correct, correct. If you're going to use one, make sure you're correct about it.
Tony Losi, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tony Losi is a USA Today reporter covering the trial of Zacharias Massawi, accused September 11th co-conspirator.
And now for a few of your letters. After hearing our story last week on digital radio in the UK, Mike Thompson wrote us all the way from East Yorkshire, England, to let us know that our reporter forgot to mention one critical fact. Digital radio there sounds terrible, and he suspects he knows why, telling us that on a recent domestic BBC radio program, it was admitted by the BBC that it is deliberately limiting the bandwidth of its broadcasts to a maximum of 128 kilobytes per second, nothing like the already available hi-fi analog FM broadcasts.
Nice investigative work, Mike. In response to last week's discussion of record companies suing individuals for copying music off the internet, Alex Fowler wrote that record companies are not only using the courts, but a little muscle as well, strong-arming cable companies into cutting off the cable service of suspected file sharers. He says he knows someone who got a call from a cable company about his son's computer. It was required, the cable company said, that the son remove music sharing software from his machine before they would restore service.
We enjoy all of your observations and, facts. So send them to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, why newspapers make mistakes and what happens when journalists get political.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A flare-up of interest in conflict of interest. The Boston Globe revealed last week that 15 reporters, including some of its own, have donated to Robert Reich's gubernatorial campaign. Broadcaster Charles Osgood is being scrutinized for his close ties with an environmental group that he covers on occasion. And in April, interviewer Charlie Rose was caught on tape by public radio's own Harry Shearer, sweet-talking shareholders of a giant corporation.
As you have seen, the Coca-Cola Company's line of communication with consumers all over the globe could not be stronger. Thanks to the Coca-Cola network, and as a result, Coca-Cola is invited to be a part of people's lives everywhere.
But when does an outside interest constitute a conflict? A small-town daily in Bay City, Michigan, recently placed its features editor on unpaid leave for displaying a political campaign sign in her yard. Never mind that the campaign was her husband's, and he put up the sign. The couple eventually removed the sign, and she returned to work on Thursday, but they're threatening legal action. Joining us now is Tony Deering, editor of the Bay City Times. Tony, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Let's first discuss the editor. Her name's Jalene Jameson. What is her job at the Times?
She is the features editor and would oversee such issues as home style, menu items.
So I'm gathering that local politics doesn't often find its way into her purview.
That is not part of her direct responsibility, no.
I'm flummoxed to imagine how her political leanings might affect how she edits an article on home styling. Was there a need to enforce this policy uniformly across the board?
Yeah. Although Jalene is our feature editor now, probably no more than a year ago, she was working as an editor on the news side and was making news decisions. She could potentially in the future move back into a news side. You know, at papers our size, people move around.
I'm presuming that the policy, when it was written, did not anticipate the question of someone whose husband, of his own free will, put up a political sign in her yard. They're married. You're asking her husband actually to waive his right to support his own candidacy just because he's married to a newspaper person.
No, actually the policy did anticipate that. I mean, we understood that this type of situation could arise. Any employer, not just a newspaper, may at times ask things of their employees which affect the spouse. For instance, someone may have a vacation requested, and the day before the vacation, their boss might call them in and say, listen, I'm sorry, we've got some real problems here. We need you here. You can't go on vacation. And obviously that affects the spouse.
We routinely expect journalists to keep not only their coverage separate from whatever their spouses may or may not be doing, but from whatever it is they may themselves think about any given issue. Is there not, however, a kind of paradox of avoiding in your personal life, expressions that are completely separate from your professional life? And isn't the insistence that there be no appearance of a conflict of interest itself kind of a dishonest way to operate? It suggests that reporters somehow are immune to political points of view.
I think that the dilemma that we're facing as a profession right now is not that we worry too much about these issues, but that we haven't worried enough. Among journalists of roughly my age or older, there are very strong feelings that you draw very clear lines, that you bend over backwards on ethical issues. Among younger journalists, I guess I detect more ambivalence. Frankly, I think that's one of the reasons why we run into some of the problems we have in the industry. As journalists, our credibility is our most important asset. I mean, if people do not have faith in the newspaper, then there's no reason to believe in it.
Are you crediting your readership sufficiently with the ability to understand the complexities of Jalene Jameson's situation?
I do think our readers have had some trouble understanding this. Some of the ethical distinctions that journalists draw are not quite as crystalline to them as they might be to someone in the profession, and I accept that.
Wouldn't a little disclosure go a long way to solving any suspicions on the part of your readers?
Yeah, well, disclosure is an important part of it. And we have in several stories before this became an issue, when we were simply doing routine stories about her husband's candidacy, made it clear to our readers that he is the wife of Jalene Jameson, feature editor at the paper. We don't think disclosure alone solves the issue.
One last thing. If they eventually decide to sell their home, they put up a for sale sign, do they have to delete the name of the realtor?
No, the rules deal with political activity, and I don't see any dilemma there.
Tony Deering, thank you very much.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Tony Deering is the editor of the Bay City Times in Bay City, Michigan.
This week, the newly appointed president of Columbia University made headlines when he put off a decision to appoint a new dean for its acclaimed journalism school. Debate first, dean later, he told his colleagues in a memo. This Friday's Wall Street Journal says the debate has the makings of an academic culture war over which is more important, teaching the craft of journalism or molding better citizens to tell the nation its news. Lee Bollinger is the new president of Columbia University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What did you mean when you wrote that to teach the craft of journalism is a worthy goal but clearly insufficient in this new world? What's insufficient?
Well, If you look at other graduate schools, whether it be in law or business or other fields, every one of them has confronted this question about how much we should have of sort of technical training or craft training of our students. What is the appropriate balance between doing that and learning, for example, about basic principles of economics or democracy or international affairs? And the ways in which they are balanced and maximized really determine how much you're serving the society and how good your university is. That's what I'm asking that the school or the university really undertake.
A lot of people think that journalism school isn't necessary at all. There are a lot of reporters that counsel young people to go study political science, go study history, go study what you're interested in so you'll be equipped to report on it later and the J school be damned.
One has to ask why that is so and whether we should offer different opportunities for people who would like to be journalists but would like a different experience than current school curriculums offer. The basic point is there is a much wider range of views about what a school of journalism should be in today's world than is true in other areas. That, to me, is something that signals we should talk about this.
But there must have been something other than a generalized need for a debate that's been going on probably for decades that had you put your foot on the brake of this hire.
If you look candidly and honestly at journalism today, I think you will see really intense debates about the quality of journalism, the forces that are at work on the profession, questions about whether commercialization is trumping journalistic ethics within universities. We are responsible for preparing people for that world and for taking responsibility for the quality of the profession, too.
But it seems to me that the problems that are endemic in journalism now, the commercialization, the tabloidization, these are things that are out of the hands, for the most part, of journalists. That particular debate happens between journalists and managers of news organizations and shareholders of news organizations who have very little in common. The best you can do is produce good journalists.
I wouldn't be so despairing. I do think it is the responsibility of a university to help people understand the dilemmas that they may be facing within their own profession. We have a responsibility, I think, to help budding journalists become good journalists and influential people.
Well, Lee Bollinger, thank you very much.
You bet.
Lee Bollinger is the new president of Columbia University. He's decided to wait a bit before choosing the next dean of Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism.
One out of two stories in your daily newspaper, and for that matter in this show probably, will likely contain some type of mistake. It may be relatively small, a grammar error or misspelled name, or something more serious, such as an incorrect or out-of-context quotation. Despite the fact that inaccuracy is among the public's biggest complaints about the press, the 50% error rate has remained the same for decades, even among the nation's most respected news organizations. On the Media's John Solomon reports.
The first time the average person realizes how many errors there are in the newspaper is usually when they read a story about a topic they know very well. That was no different for the editor of the nation's largest newspaper.
Virtually every story that was written about me when I took over as editor of USA Today had an error in it. And that was more than 3 years ago, and the track record hasn't changed much.
Editor-in-chief Karen Jorgensen.
I was surprised and disheartened by that, and it made me think if I see errors, readers see them as well.
She's not wrong about that. A poll by the Pew Research Center for the People in the Press late last year found that only 47% of the public think the press, quote, gets the facts straight, unquote. That perception appears to be reality. Studies have continually shown that about half of all stories have an error in them. The newest analysis, a recently published academic survey of news sources of the Raleigh, North Carolina News Observer, found that 59% of the articles printed in early 1999 had at least one mistake. Obviously, the first draft of history is not going to be perfect. Between spellings, statistics, and precise quotations, hundreds of facts go into every story, usually written by human beings on deadline. While many errors are understandable, Tom Rosenstiel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, says they shouldn't all be acceptable.
The problem with accuracy is not that we get names misspelled, but it's what inaccuracies say to the public about the press. And they say that maybe we're slipshod in general, that we're not entirely trustworthy as a profession, not because there are inaccuracies per se, but because we just don't seem to worry about this stuff.
There are signs that the press is beginning to worry. After her own experience, Jorgensen launched an error reduction program at USA Today and created a task force that will report its recommendations by the end of the year. The New York Times established a new position of corrections commissioner last year after top editors acknowledged the paper was making too many mistakes. And the American Society of Newspaper Editors recently completed its own initiative to bring attention to the problem. Practically every other American manufacturing business long ago underwent comprehensive anti-defect quality control programs. The media, by and large, has not gone through the same kind of re-engineering. But it appears change may be on the way. Karn Jorgensen.
We had an editor one day look at some of this material and say, you know, some of these are the kinds of things that would involve a reporter taking the last 5 minutes of an interview and just saying, now let me go over these facts again. Let's go over the spelling of your name again. Let's go over your age again. Some fairly basic things like that.
The news organization which has addressed the error problem most extensively is the Chicago Tribune. It hired a retired editor to carefully review the paper for mistakes and then began tracking all errors by category. That immediately addressed some reoccurring trouble spots, according to Margaret Holt, the Tribune's consumer service editor, who manages the paper's quality control program. For example, in obituaries,
one year we found that something like two-thirds of all the errors involve mistakes in either the time of the memorial service, the name of the deceased or the survivors, or the date of the memorial service.
Now, each section of the paper receives a quarterly error report with results and any problematic trends. The highly quantitative analysis is key, says Holt, because what gets measured ultimately gets managed.
Numbers make it easier for people to visualize what the issues are that you're talking about. That's much more effective than being able to say, golly shucks darn, we need to do a better job, and we got to stop making these stupid mistakes. People in the newsrooms are really smart people. They're not looking for people to point the finger at them and tell them how dumb they are. They're looking for people to say, what are those, what can we learn from them, and how might we do this?
Finding answers to those questions should be particularly important to the press right now. The Pew survey revealed that in the eyes of the public, inaccuracy is second only to bias as a reason to distrust the press. And bias actually may be more a problem of accuracy than ideology. In fact, when news sources were polled in the study of the News Observer, those who complained about bias usually blamed process more than politics. University of Oregon journalism professor Scott Mayer authored the study, which was published in the winter 2002 issue of Newspaper Research Journal.
I don't think they saw it as a political bias or agenda setting, but rather that the reporter just didn't take the time to put that story in context and to be fair and to present all points of view.
Mayer says the News Observer's willingness to allow his survey to be released to the public should be a model for other media organizations. And since the press will never be able to eliminate mistakes, more transparency might be a good way to help restore the media's credibility. The public doesn't expect the media to be perfect, but maybe a little bit more candid about its imperfections. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
They're in virtually every city and town in America, leaned on, trashed on, open, closed, and ignored. I mean the humble newspaper rack, a ubiquitous piece of street furniture pretty much unchanged since it was designed in 1957. Kevin Hellicker wrote in the Wall Street Journal about the current marketing war raging between the traditional green metal box, called TK80 when it was modestly updated some years back, and a host of other sleek new designs.
The new machines are architecturally pleasing. They allow you to look at the front page of the paper without bending over, which is a big problem with the TK80. And they also are slanted at the top so that people can't leave their trash and cups on them. What they're mainly trying to sell to newspapers is the idea that a better-looking machine and a machine that was more user-friendly might reverse a years-long decline in news rack sales. News racks used to account for more than 50% of single copy sales at newspapers, and it's down to 35%. And this is the big debate in the industry. Is that decline attributable to societal trends such as the rise of convenience stores, or is it a case of newspapers having failed to invest in the kinds of news racks that would help boost sales?
What about just the decline in newspaper readership generally?
Well, there's a question the industry isn't too eager to explore that deeply, but an investment in better-looking machines that are all rusted out might help reverse that decline a little bit.
Since those new machines have been out there at least a little bit, have they had any discernible impact in the sale of newspapers?
The Bakersfield Californian has swapped out half of its 200 racks for a new model and has since then posted a 1% increase
in
sales. Now, the Californian claims that that represents significant progress because before that, sales were declining. But others would point to that as evidence that the investment really isn't worthwhile.
You know, it always struck me that these machines represented what might be considered the last evidence of the honor system in America. You put in a quarter, you open it up, you can take one newspaper or you can take all of them, as some of the down-and-outers in New York City do, and then they sell them for a discount in the subway. Have stolen newspapers posed any kind of significant problem?
Stolen newspapers represent about 2% of the total put out there, and they have represented a problem. The new machines aren't able to keep people from taking as many papers as they want. Some of them do have technology inside the machine, however, that will tell the machine operator if 20 papers suddenly disappear at exactly 3:15, so that the paper could then keep somebody on watch there if it happened repeatedly.
Which would cost them even more money.
Exactly.
Well, what about bringing back the newsboy yelling, extra, extra, read all about it?
I suspect that that was probably the heyday of the single copy sales. Although the problem with hawkers, as they called them, is that they were out there for only certain hours. And the great thing about the newspaper machine is it's standing there on guard 24 hours a day ready to sell that paper.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Heliker is a staff writer for The Wall Street Journal in Chicago. Coming up, the media summer of missing children and television ad absurdum.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Newsweek had the story, When Children Go Missing. But it added this comforting qualifier, take heart, this is not an epidemic. Last year's summer of shark attacks has made way for this season's abducted children. But most reports are careful to note that relatively few, maybe 100 this year, will be taken by strangers. A horrendous figure, but far less than generally believed. And it hasn't stopped our collective anxiety, reflected in this week's episode of Comedy Central's South Park.
Sit down and have some coffee, son. Tweak, there's starting to be a lot of reports on the news about children being abducted, and we thought we should talk.
I saw!
You know never to talk to strangers, right, Tweak? You can't trust anybody.
Oh, God!
Now, we don't want to alarm you, son, but we've installed new locks on your bedroom windows and door. It's important for you to know never to unlock them at night for anyone except your mother and I.
Oh, Jesus!
It's just a precaution, sweetie. Probably nothing will ever happen.
But that's a cartoon. We sent out our associate producer, Katya Rogers, to find out what real people feel on a street during lunchtime in Lower Manhattan.
Do you have a rough idea of how many kids are abducted by strangers every year?
1,700 in the United States.
200 a day?
I would say 100,000 within a year.
Okay, I'm going to tell you how many really are. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children says that this year there'll be around 100 children kidnapped by strangers.
If you would have said maybe within a day, I would accept that answer. But within a year, it sounds too low. You hear things on the news practically every day. And if you can hear 7 days a week on the news, and we're talking about a year, the number sounds too low.
How many kids do you think are abducted by strangers a year?
I don't know. 2,300?
The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children this year projects that it's going to be around 100.
You hate to hear that news, and, you know, you hate to hear it about one child, but I'm just glad the figures are less than what I thought.
I know it's increasing here lately, some kind of epidemic sickness.
Like the Elizabeth Smart, Samantha Runyon, you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So would you be surprised if you knew that it's actually around 100?
I think maybe the media is making too much out of it then. It goes out of your mind if it's not in the media every day. You tend to focus on other things, the war, you know, your rent.
Luke Kilzer is an investigative reporter for the Rocky Mountain News. In 1985, he and colleague Diana Griego wrote about the hysteria surrounding inflated numbers of missing children. Their work won the Denver Post a Pulitzer Prize. Lou, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be here.
We've just heard from some New Yorkers who guesstimated the number of abducted kids a year to be in the thousands. Deja vu for you?
Kind of. When I was thinking about coming on the program, I thought back to what it was like in 1984 and 85. And here in Denver, parents were actually lining up around the block to get into Safeway stores to have their children fingerprinted for when they were abducted, their remains could be identified that way. And all the milk cartons had missing children. In the buses, there were posters of missing children. There was just a deep and unreasonable fear at that time. And this time, I don't see that happening.
Let's just go back to 84 and 85 for a moment.
Sure.
There were groups warning at that time that 1.5 million kids were disappearing every year and that 50,000 children were kidnapped by strangers, that 4,000 kids in the United States were murdered. Were those numbers actually being disseminated, and by whom?
They were being disseminated by various groups around the country and also by the media. It actually, the 1.5 million that you use, that was kind of on the conservative side on some of the reports. There was a lady in Florida that was reporting, and it was picked up in the press, that there were 2.5 million children that were vanishing every year in the United States. I remember calling the lady up and once we had solid figures and saying, how can you say this? And her comment to me was, well, just because we say they vanish doesn't mean they don't reappear. And it was interesting how often people in my profession simply picked up these figures without really thinking about them because they were somewhat illogical and repeated them. The FBI prints every month, or at least did then, the number of missing children reports. Then if you added up all the missing children reports for a year, you would come up with a pretty large figure, not 1.5 million, but a large figure. But what the groups weren't doing, and this is, it's embarrassingly simple to have analyzed this, was that there's another column next to the number of missing children reports. That is of children that reported missing that were discovered. And if you balance those figures, you came out with a fairly small number. And of the missing children, I believe we said 94-95% of them were runaways. Most of the others, when there was a, quote, abduction, it was a parental abduction in a custody dispute. There was a vanishingly small number that were actually missing through a stranger abduction.
I guess the silver lining to all of the misreporting 16, 17 years ago was that it did bring attention to the problem of parental abductions. And there has been some legislation passed in the intervening time making it more difficult for one spouse to spirit a child away from another. But tell me what the negative effects of this kind of mass hysteria were.
Well, we actually got around to calling up Dr. Spock on that issue and other child psychologists. Dr. Spock said that children have a particularly morbid imagination, and they knew what was happening when they were being fingerprinted, and they were extrapolating from that. I'll tell you this story. My son was very young at the time, and he said he wanted to go and find the missing children. And I was kind of stunned and asked him, where would you find them? And he said, well, they're going to be in the dumpsters. I've been working on the numbers, Diana and I, but at that point, it really sunk in what the possible consequences were. I mean, my son was thinking that children are being dispensed in dumpsters throughout Denver, and it simply was not the case. They called our story in 1985 the nation's largest correction. I mean, it was a paper saying, well, we've all been wrong, including the Denver Post, which I was writing for. I think the media, having seen those reports, and that the report won the Public Service Pulitzer Prize, the media will be reluctant to repeat those figures or to get too out of hand. At least I hope so.
Can you imagine back in 1984 and 85 when we were awash in flyers and milk cartons with little kids' pictures staring back at us? What would have happened if there were four cable news networks then?
I think it would have been catastrophic. It would have. It's hard to imagine that things could have gotten more hysterical. No, that would be a nightmare meltdown scenario. Hopefully someone would have blown the whistle earlier, but sometimes in the din, the whistle can't be heard. In 1985, it was heard. Today, I doubt it.
Lou Kilzer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lou Kilzer is an investigative reporter for the Rocky Mountain News.
And now, an entirely new concept in TV production from the people who brought you Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. It's called Live from Tomorrow, a live variety news and entertainment show aimed at young people. What's new is that it won't need commercial breaks because the sponsors are built right in as part of the show. Movies, music, high-tech gadgets will all be featured and extolled organically, say the producers, who are currently pitching a 6-episode run next summer. Maddie Lesham is Executive Vice President of Diplomatic, the production company for Live from Tomorrow. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Describe, if you will, exactly how the advertiser will fit into the programming.
I'll use an example. We just saw a brilliant line of new cell phones coming out from Sony Ericsson. They're really revolutionary. They have cameras in them. They do all kinds of amazing things. We might play a game with 100 people who will come down to the studio. We will give them the brand new Sony Ericsson phone that has a camera in it, and we will allow them to go on a scavenger hunt through America, which is sort of a mini reality show, with the help of their friends online. And they have to photograph fantastic landmarks throughout America as part of the game. And the person who photographs in the most creative, artistic way will win a prize. This is a show that says, here's an interesting product. We're interested in it. We think you'll be interested in it. And here's a way for you to look at it that you might find appealing.
Which also increases credibility, since most people, as we know, tend to regard commercials rather skeptically.
There's good reason. Commercials are there for the sole purpose of selling you a product. The idea with this is, it's not Consumer Reports. We're talking about, you know, a new device that happens to be really unbelievably useful, has new technology in it that we haven't seen before.
I mean, Maddie, unbelievably useful, or maybe not. I mean, you don't necessarily have the best product on the program. You have the advertiser on the program.
That's an interesting point. Right now, there aren't any other phones out there with cameras, but Motorola, I hear, is going to come out with one. This is not a show that is here to say, this is the best product and you should buy it. The great thing about this is that we don't have to take every advertiser. There are a lot of products that I think wouldn't work in the show. Also, not everything that you're going to see in the show is a product. This show is going to have a heavy musical component in it.
Yeah, but they're all products. their records, their CDs. We understand that this would replace the network commercials, but what distinguishes your approach from product placement?
Well, it's actually quite different. I mean, product placement is usually, with few exceptions, pretty inorganic. The bag of potato chips or Doritos in Survivor sort of seems like it doesn't really fit. Like, what's it doing there in the middle of this island? What we've tried to do is actually build an organic script around a product.
Like a lot of children's cartoon shows have been doing for years.
I'm not sure that's a really apt analogy. People haven't really created shows around the ideas of a product and what it can do.
Actually, though, you have certain cartoon shows that basically feature the toys as the principal characters.
That's true, and those exist. It's very hard for me to explain why it's different other than to say there's something very blatant about that, something that I think becomes very clear that that's the only reason it's there.
Right.
In other words, it isn't organically part of the script. It's merely saying, here's the toy, we're going to put it in, we'll find a way to use it because we want to sell this toy.
I guess it feels a little closer to infomercials.
I think that your need to try to analogize it to things that already exist is understandable. There might be a little bit of an infomercial quality to it, but the truth of the matter is it doesn't look like an infomercial. It doesn't feel like an infomercial. And the goal of it is not to sell products out of the show, which is the goal of an infomercial.
It's the goal of the advertiser who funds the program, certainly.
Listen, I think that the notion that there's something wrong with commercial products being involved in our programming is a pretty old-fashioned idea. The business of television is driven by commercials and is driven by commercial money. I sort of sense that you think that there's something sort of Machiavellian or evil about it. There really isn't. I think the important thing about our show is that it's completely transparent to the viewer what it is. We're not trying to product place something. We're not trying to hide something in the show. We're very upfront about the fact that this show surrounds itself around new and interesting products that people actually want to know about.
I don't think it's Machiavellian. I think that simply people tend to be more relaxed when there's a clear line between advertising and content. They seem to be more comfortable when they know, okay, now I'm being sold to and now I'm being entertained.
Well, I think you're making certain assumptions there that may or may not be true. I think there's a group of young people out there who are really interested and would understand that if we're showing them something, that this new product is actually part of the show that we are presenting to them. And we don't intend to hide that in any way. We want that to be unbelievably transparent to the viewer. And we actually don't think that there's a problem with it at all.
Maddie, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Maddie Lesham is the Executive Vice President of Diplomatic, the production company creating a show without commercials.
Some people might suggest Lou Gehrig's retirement speech. Others might nominate FDR's announcement of the attack on Pearl Harbor. For some of us, though, the most moving words of the 20th century may be these.
Meow, 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 meow.
They moved a lot of cat food anyway. And now, with a mind to moving still more, comes a proposal for a new television program, Meow TV, the first show produced for an audience of cats. Richard Thompson is the CEO of the Meow Mix Company and producer of Meow TV. Richard, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
All right, Meow TV. What kind of programming are we talking about?
We're going to have kind of two pieces of it. One piece is going to be things that cats might be interested in watching. It could be fish swimming by or chasing squirrels or, you know, watching dogs do something, you know, maybe music that cats might like. The other part will be things that the owners of cats would like to know about. It could be what a vacation with your cat. It could be how to treat your cat with pet treats, things like that.
Cats have extremely limited buying power. I mean, even if you give a cat a dollar, you know, chances are it's just going to bat it around the room. How do you intend to convert Meow TV, entertainment for cats, into revenue for you or for advertisers?
We think that's going to, you know, be something that will help us extend the brand and get people into the brand earlier and keep people in the brand longer, because I think that we can really bring some good programming to cat owners and cats.
At the moment, you have no distribution for this show. It's strictly theoretical at this stage?
That's correct. It's strictly theoretical with the idea that we're going to do this in two steps. We're going to find the Meow TV personality, both the voice and the host of Meow TV. Then the second thing will be to find a media partner.
All right, well, forgive me if I sound suspicious, but I guess I am by nature. This has all the indications of being a publicity stunt. You have the tour looking for talent, but you don't actually have a television program. What do you suppose the chances are that Meow TV will ever see the light of day?
Well, with me running the business, it will absolutely 100% see the light of day. So you will see at least one segment of Meow TV.
Even if you have to buy 30 minutes of time from some cable channel?
Absolutely. You will see one segment of Meow TV, but the idea is to have multiple segments and make Meow TV work, because I'm totally convinced that everybody in a country knows meow, 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 meow. So I think that this is a very strong business idea as well as a good PR idea.
Everybody knows about Midas mufflers, too, but they don't want to see a show about it.
Well, everybody has a muffler, but mufflers are dirty and nasty and underneath the car and have road dirt. And, you know, cats sit on your lap and cats are your best friends. So I think there's a huge difference between mufflers and cats.
Richard Thompson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Richard Thompson is CEO of the Meow Mix Company and producer of the maybe upcoming Meow TV. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by Dylan Keefe, George Edwards, and Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Dan Bobkoff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. We'd like to welcome the latest addition to the On the Media empire, High Plains Public Radio, which extends the OTM tentacles across western Kansas, eastern Colorado, and the Texas and Oklahoma panhandles. Thanks for picking us up. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Ding, ding! I want chicken, I want liver. Meow mix, please deliver.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.